current. Later that night, reused, worn-down candles sit on the kitchen table. They light the wall behind, where a wooden plaque is mounted. The family name, Johnson, is burnt into it and decorated with the child's attempts at flowers and stars. At the table beneath the plaque, Joe Jr., Henry James, and Delphi sit quietly, tear-stained. In the distance, they hear the cry of the powerful owl. He's a little early with his calling. He's not usually heard until winter. Delphi wipes her runny nose with the back of her hand. A noise grabs Joe Jr.'s attention, and he looks over to the bedroom, the other room in the shanty. There, his ma and brother, both looking deathly pale, are lying side by side on a large, homemade stretcher bed, branches for bedposts and wooden slats for the base under a lumpy old Hessian mattress. Two single stretcher beds line the walls. The children share these. Delphi tries to speak through little sobs.
Is Ma and Danny gonna wake soon? I want them to wake up now.
They're just resting. They've had a bad day. Wise words from a young soul. Finally, Molly stirs. The children at the table sit upright with anticipation. In her slumber, Molly throws an arm over Danny, cradling her precious eldest son. She murmurs something inaudible, then her breathing settles to an even rhythm. A hungry stomach growls. Delphi places her hand over her belly.
Excuse me,
she apologizes politely. Joe Jr. looks at her, knowing there is nothing to eat. He gets up all the same, hoping by some miracle there is food in the cupboard. On the shelves, there is only a small amount of flour in a calico sack. He goes to the vegetable box. Nothing. He opens the lid of the meat box. Nothing in there either. Henry James joins him, peering into the empty meat box.
Has it been 3 months yet?
Not sure what 3 months is. Guess it might be. They move over to the stove that sits in the big old River Rock chimney. It's the only real solid structural mass in the shanty. If a big gust of wind came through, it would blow the rest of the shack away. But while their abode is run down, despite the dire conditions, it is quaint and homely. It's clear that Molly has tried to make it a home, but the room is bare of any indulgences. A table and chairs, a cupboard for food, and a utility cupboard line one wall. The stove is at one end, and on the other wall the veggie and meat boxes sit, as well as a small bench for preparing food. The rag doll that caused all the chaos hangs over Molly's makeshift rocking chair, drying. The boys sit on the dirt floor, which has managed to dry to a reasonable firmness. Delphi joins them, fitting snugly between her brothers.
If the 3 months is up, that means the baby be here soon, she says.
Joe Jr. nods at his little sister, and Henry James adds,
and Darby home, with supplies. We'll eat good then, Delphi.
Delphi rubs at her hungry belly, which makes another little noise.
But I'm hungry now.
Joe Jr. gently places a caring arm around his little sister, the only comfort he can offer. The children stare at the stove that does not provide for them tonight. It's going to be a long night on empty stomachs. The sun hangs high in a cloudless sky. Danny, a little gaunt, sits in the dirt, focused on writing his name. He prides himself on his penmanship, although he writes with his finger. He wishes he had a notepad to preserve his efforts. Delphi, who is never too far from her big brother, sits beside him playing with her rag doll. She rubs its tummy and holds the doll to her ear, as if it is whispering to her. Delphi looks down at her rag doll with empathy.
You shouldn't talk about how hungry you are. That only makes it worse.
She gets up and takes her doll over to play by the old snow gum. Joe Jr. and Henry James play on the wood heap out the front. It's low on wood. A mound protrudes beneath it, making the ground uneven. Just beyond it is the old snow gum where Delphi and her doll play. The snow gum marks the end of the cleared area of the front yard. Beyond that are perfectly placed white sallies marking the perimeter of Molly's property. And beyond these trees are further young saplings, scrub and thicket. The land then drops away to the river below. To the left, the south, are the floodplains. You can see the river stretch out before you, snaking its way through the land. But due to the ridge and the trees, perfectly placed boulders and thicket, Molly's home is hidden. She has the advantage of seeing who is coming, but any visitor has to get lost to find her. Just the way she likes it, isolated from the world. Giggles and ruckus can be heard from the two younger boys who were lost in their game of jumping on the mound of dirt under the dwindling wood heap. Delphi happily plays quietly with her doll. Danny continues to write his name in the dirt. He is extra somber this morning, and rightly so. He experienced a great ordeal yesterday and is still a little shaken up. He rewrites his name in the damp earth, claiming his place here on dry land. Making his mark in this life, perhaps. Molly lies in bed, staring at the gaps in her slat roof. The streams of sunlight shining through the cracks have disturbed her slumber. She wipes at a tear that falls down her cheek. Is she crying, or is it the glare from the sunlight? She rolls over and closes her eyes, allowing the tears to fall freely. She can't help herself. Molly Johnson rarely cries, but her face distorts with the pain of yesterday, the fear that ran through her as she fought the raging river, wondering whether she would ever see her children again. But her cries are unheard, her silent screams only for her. She doesn't want to alarm the children, a practice she's done many times before. After a moment, as quickly as the crying started, it stops. There is no one to hear, no one to confide in or to comfort her. No one cares, so why bother? Crying gets you nowhere, is what her da always said. Molly slowly lifts herself from the bed and wipes her tears away with the back of her hand, wipes her nose with the hem of her dress. She takes another moment and pushes up from the bed, then slowly makes her way to the front door. Her worry is replaced with calm and strength as she nears the opening. Her mind moves forward to today, this very moment, to be here in the present and so happy to be there. She's had her time to dwell on what could have been. Now it's time to hatch a plan for how to get through this day. But her relief is short-lived as she realizes she is not well. Her body aches, as it should from what she's been through, but this pain is deep, in her joints, and Molly realizes she has a fever. Oh, dear. This is all I need. A sickness from the water I swallowed in the flood. Molly leans against the doorframe. In the light of day, she looks exhausted and pale. She is certainly unwell. She can't hide that. Her pregnant belly is prominent as her undergarments, wet from fever, cling to her. You two boys, get away from that wood heap. Not going to tell yous again. Get around back and play. Henry James and Joe Jr. scamper off giggling. Little rascals, Molly thinks. Her attention falls on her eldest son. Danny, you up to riding to the McGinnises? Danny doesn't look up. He finishes the word, his name, again. Danny. He punctuates his finish with a full stop. Burying his finger in the soft earth, frustrated, angry. He would never truly let his ma see this side of him. It is very rare that he rebels or disrespects an order from her. Knowing it's his job to see his brothers and sister safely to the McGinnises when Molly is due to give birth, he says, "Don't look like you dropped enough yet, ma." Molly can't help but smile, her hand gliding over her pregnant belly, her son far beyond his years. "For food, son," she tells him. Danny doodles in the dirt, not too eager to move. "Everton's not just over the hill, ma." "I know it's a long way to town, son." Molly looks to the wood heap again and exhales deeply. Denny hears this and understands his ma's worry. "We need to fell a tree," she says. "The deadwood isn't going to last us the winter." He gets up, dusting off the seat of his pants, but the moisture in the soil stains his bottom. "I'll get to that too." He heads around the back, looking for his dog. "Alligator!" But the big black mixed breed he found as a half-starved little puppy doesn't come running. The dog's been away before, but not this long. Danny calls again, louder this time, and his voice echoes, bouncing off the vast mountain range. "Alligator!" But no dog comes running. Stepping high through the clusters of browning tussock grass, he can hear his ma coughing violently as she heads back inside. "Blasted dog," Danny thinks as he gathers the horse's saddle blanket and bridle from a little lean-to shed at the side of the yard. He approaches the wooden fence holding yard, slipping under the top rail. The yard is in urgent need of repair. If the grey speckled mare wasn't so faithful, she could have easily stepped over the broken rails and walked off. She can often be found out of the yard, and after eating her fill of fresh grass, will walk herself back in for the night. Dimples is their only form of transport into town for supplies, errands, or help. She is a valued and much loved family member. And there she is, the old mare, the family's faithful workhorse, standing in the yard, her back swayed from the weight of carrying children and supplies over the years. She would sometimes accompany Joe on his droves up to the high country carrying supplies. He would later set her loose and she would immediately find her way home. Today the animal's head hangs low. Danny takes no notice. He is preoccupied with his annoyance about going to town and wondering where his blasted dog is. As he nears Dimples, he mumbles swear words under his breath that he would never say loud enough for his ma to hear. She doesn't like it when he cusses. He sounds too much like his da. Danny throws the blanket over the back of the horse and her legs buckle. He jumps back out of harm's way as she hits the ground hard with the final expiration of air from her nostrils and arse. The boy is left standing there, stunned and staring at the dead animal. He looks at the horse's head and sees that her mouth is swollen and has two puncture marks highlighted by blood. Danny squats beside her for a closer inspection. Snake bite. He runs his hand through her mane, offering soft, solemn words of thanks. He affectionately pats the head of their faithful mare, perplexed as to what to do now. With food so low and his ma close to giving birth, how the hell are they going to get to town? How's he going to manage to get the others to the McGinnises when his ma's ready to give birth? She always sends them in, gives her rest and some quiet bonding time with the baby. "This is my fault," Danny thinks. "I shouldn't have been swearing." He sits back from the dead horse. "Blast it. I'm going to have to dig a bloody hole to bury the bastard." Danny hugs his knees. In the light of day, the land around him and his family is of heroic proportions. The colossal mountain range stretches to the north and south, and the thick scrub country dwarfs Molly and her children isolated within it. Danger anywhere and everywhere. A crow circles once, twice, three times, then flies off towards the mountain range. Up and over. Chapter 6. Over the mountain range lies another property that belongs to a family with money, the Edwards. Cleared land, neatly cut hedges mark the perimeter of a red brick homestead and manicured lawns. The Edwards family were among the first white settlers in the area and are considered among the founding fathers. They came to the high country in the early 1820s, looking for more land to graze their livestock. The patriarch, Charles, led the trip with his youngest son, Neville, and five other men, leaving his mother, Evelyn, wife, Florence, and daughter-in-law, Eleanor, with their hired help, a simpleton boy of about 17 years old, to help with any manual labour. These white men befriended the local Narigo tribe and learnt about the land from these original inhabitants. King Jimmy, a name given to the head elder of the Narigo by the troopers who had passed through the outpost of Crest Hill in the valley below, fell under the spell of the good-natured, sweet-talking, gift-giving Charles Edwards. The Narigo elder showed the white men the hidden tracks of the high country that were invisible to the untrained eye. The Narigo had ancient connections to this country, dating back to when time began. They were intrigued by the white man they had heard about. Other nations and tribes who gathered for the Bogong Moth celebrations brought stories, songs, and dances about their encounters with the pale-skinned beings who were first thought to be lost relatives returning to them from the clouds. That story soon changed. The pale-skins could not be trusted, and any business with them must be undertaken with caution. But when the leading elder of the Narigo saw the white man with his own eyes, he was astounded and intrigued at their pale skin, many shades of coloured hair and eyes, and the cloth that covered their bodies from neck to foot. They smelt, and some had body shapes that looked wrong to the Narigo. This kind would hold up the tribe, the elder thought, examining an overweight stockman. He would be considered sickly and would be left behind. The Narigo elder thought that the pale skins elder needed a stern talking to about the care of his clan, but it was not his place to impose his values and conditions on others. It was all very intriguing. To the Narigo, they were the superior, and for their amusement, they toyed with the out-of-shape harmless pale skins and obliged their inquiries. Talk was passed around about the cloth that covered their pale bodies. Are these pale creatures ashamed to show their masculinity and their athletic prowess? The Narigo weren't even sure that they were men. They could not see their male appendage. The others, who are soft, could be the females, was one comment. Laughter was shared as they attempted to lift the round belly of one of the more mature men, which hung over his long loincloth. They were looking for his dun, his penis. The stockman backed away, shaking his head, waving his arms in defence. The Narigo men then thought that he must be a woman. The high country was breathtakingly beautiful, the perfect place, the whites nodded in agreement, to graze their sheep and fatten them up before the winter sales. The Narigo thought the white men were agreeing with them on the beauty of the place, understanding the Narigo's connection to the land through complex songlines crossing this country and its plentiful edible plant life that has sustained them for many, many years. But the two groups of men didn't know or understand that, with each of their respective head nods, they were agreeing to totally different things. This misunderstanding was the start of the demise and destruction of the area, and this destruction did not just mean the plant life. Charles Edwards, his son Neville, and the other men stayed for a few nights in the area with the blacks, thinking them childish, naive, and uneducated in the ways of the civilized Western world. The Narigo thought the pale creatures as dismal beings, not schooled in the ancient lore of their great land. King Jimmy said, "I would like to educate these beings in our ways, so they can appreciate our knowledge of the land and sky and the ways of our clans." Most of the Narigo men did not see the sense in this and hoped the white men would just look and leave. They shared a meal of kangaroo, and the pale skin with the hanging round belly was given one of King Jimmy's wives. She led him into a gunji, and not long after came running out, half laughing, but also a little scared. As she scampered by King Jimmy, she said, "The round belly one is a Marinj. He has a dun. It's old, small one too." All the Narigo roared with laughter. The whites were left bewildered and wondering. Unfortunately for the Narigo women, the white men could not help but be drawn to their beauty. Shining in the moonlight, their fresh young pointed breasts, pouting soft full lips, small waists and high buttocks, and long, well-shaped legs. With the full moon's beams bouncing off the women's velvet black skin, the white men found it hard to resist their primal urges. But their greed and pompous sense of entitlement led to brutal rapes. The white men demanded silence, holding the Narigo women against their will at knife and gunpoint as the taking began. The whites' brutality against the Narigo women quickly caused unrest among the Narigo men. A young Narigo warrior came for his wife to find her crying, scratch marks on her shoulders and buttocks, and her mouth bleeding. She told her husband through sobs of pain and shame what had happened. The youngest white man had taken her against her will. He acted like a dalaga, a wild man with no control or care. He had bitten down on her voluptuous lips, drawing blood, and clawed at her like the wombat digging his burrow. Angered, the young warrior immediately summoned the others and told them what he had learnt. They held council, and a decision was made to confront the white men and demand punishment for their acts, but they were long gone. Charles knew about his youngest son's sexual fetish. Neville rarely showed this side, but when he did, it was Charles who coughed up money to soften the blows on the prostitutes Neville bit and bruised. Charles never said a word to anyone about it, especially Neville's new wife. To take out his disgusting urges on a gin was safer than revealing his deviant sexual ways to Eleanor, the beautiful young woman from Melbourne he'd made his wife. Charles didn't want her running off until an heir had been born. But Charles Edwards carried great sins of his own. He also took a young Aboriginal girl by force that night. She was about 14 years old, and unbeknown to Charles, the youngest promised wife to King Jimmy. She was a virgin and became pregnant to Charles. When the baby was born with fine features and fair skin, King Jimmy wanted her killed immediately. He felt she was a bad omen for the tribe and its clans, and that his young wife had deceived him. He did not entirely blame her for this. Stories of the treatment of the young warrior's wife and those told by others who had finally come forward suggested to King Jimmy his young wife would not have wanted to go willingly with the out-of-shape, smelly pale skin. But her mixed-blood baby was another story. Was it fit enough to be part of the clan? Was it weaker because of its tainted blood? The young Aboriginal mother had no choice but to leave the newborn out under her birthing tree on the night she was born. She asked the ancient ancestors to watch over the baby girl and give her strength to survive the night. If she survived, she would be considered strong enough to be included in the clan. The next morning before dawn, the young mother went to her baby and found her alive and well. She had triumphantly survived the night. The baby girl was named Warragunj, after the snow gum tree under which she had been born. Some in the tribe, mainly King Jimmy's other wives, did not like it. They thought the young mother useless to allow herself to become with child to the pale skin intruder, so they banished her and her daughter. Warragunj and her young mother drifted on the outskirts of the tribe for a few years until the mother returned to the clan showing her swollen pregnant belly and demanded a place beside King Jimmy and his other wives because she was now carrying his child. The tribe finally let her and her two-year-old daughter back in. Warragunj was soon promised to another tribesman from one of the coastal clans. 16 winters passed, and then her time came. She was to go to him. She gathered her things and was due to start her journey to his country the next morning. But instead of going with him, she ran from the tribe, her clan, her mother, her younger siblings, and the protection her extended family could offer her. From a young age, she'd had a curious mind and an adventurous and rebellious spirit. Her mother and her siblings blamed her tainted blood for her rebellion against law, but they loved her dearly. She often made them laugh when she played the clown at story time. and as one of the most skilled dancers in the clan, she made her family proud. Her red hair, fair skin, and finer features made her rather exotic looking, and the young warriors lusted after her. But she could not help the way she looked. She paid them no heed and kept her virtue intact and her self-respect high. But she always felt she was an outsider. The other women in the clan would taunt her with their sharp-tongued insults. Life for Warragunge within the tribe would have been a different story if she'd been King Jimmy's flesh and blood. The night she ran away, Warragunge served her promised husband his meal and sat with him through council with King Jimmy and then with her mother to talk. For a long while she just held her mother's hand as they sat around the family fire and watched the younger siblings tell of their day's adventures through song and dance, roaring with laughter at some of their unfortunate mishaps. When the others, including her promised husband, went off to their gunjis to sleep, Warragunge asked if her mother would stay with her a little longer. They sat in silence for a few moments more. Then Warragunge opened up about a dream she'd had. In the dream, she stood on a cliff in her promised husband's land, raging water beneath her, calling as the waves reached up and splashed at her feet. She felt the full weight of this new world crushing her chest and taking her breath away. And she fought hard to breathe again. Her mother reassured her that this was a normal feeling, but Warragunge continued, giving no heed to the words of her Nadjan, her mother. "There is a path to this side, on the side where my heart lies. It leads me away, Nadjan." There was instant fear in her mother's eyes. It led away and back down the cliff. It was narrow and dangerously close to the edge, rugged with big boulders, but it kept going for a long, long way off into the distance, Nagan. Warragunge explained to her mother that the narrow path with the obstacles was her path to take, and she had to leave. She would not go to her promised husband. Together, they cried. This could bring death to Warragunge. They held each other tight, her Nagar knowing that she could not say anything that would change her daughter's mind. "For your safety, Warragunge, I will not raise the alarm until well after the sun has risen." Warragunge held her mother, knowing this was the last time she would feel her Najan's warmth, safety and care, squeezing her tight and showing her thanks for her understanding. Looking deep into her soul, Warragunge Nadjan said, "My love for you is as ancient as this land, as beautiful as a flittering butterfly, and forever joyous as a bubbling spring. Always know it is me in the rustle of the leaves of treetops, watching, following." Warragunge didn't know how to respond to her mother's beautiful words, but she tried her best. "My love for you is as pure as the first opening of a wildflower in spring. My love for you is forever as a blue sky on a summer's day. It will be strong and survive like the cavernous rocky walls that have shaped and still guide the great river. You gave me life. You willed me to live. You stood by me. And Nadjan, the choice I make tonight and my action that will take me from here are because you believe in me. I'm a fighter. I've been fighting all my life, and I will not stop fighting until my last breath. Stay safe, Nadjan. Stay well." I take my mother's face gently in my hands, wiping the tears from her eyes. I kiss her on both cheeks, breathing in her scent one last time. Nadjan clenches a fist, steadying me with a firm grasp on my arm, then touches her fist softly to my forehead. As she has done for as long as I can remember, she blows through it, whispering, "Always with you." This alone gives me strength and determination. I slip quietly away into the night. There is no full moon to guide me. perfect for an unseen escape, no moonbeams to highlight my pale skin. What Warragunj failed to see as she left was her mother's heartbreak, and she never knew that 3 days after her leaving, her Najan's broken heart gave way. Warragunj's mother was found sleeping eternally under a beautiful old snow gum. The old gum's trunk, still glistening from rainfall, filled the valley with a rainbow of colour. Times were getting tough for the Narigo and their neighbouring nations. More white people were coming and taking land, putting up fences, driving blacks away and off their homelands. They were not free to live with the changing seasons as they once had. They now lived to survive and stayed out of sight. By their own law, the white man had the right to shoot any black on sight, to eradicate or to disperse the heathen savages. The blacks cannot and will not hold up the forward progress of building this nation. We will disperse them. For queen and country, we will prevail. Charles Edwards was a regular at these district meetings and often led the discussions. He was the first to propose that the outpost Crest Hill be marked for possible development in the near future. If the troopers could disperse the blacks, a town for the area could be considered. There's already a major stock route that cuts through, and with more farmers and settlers arriving, a town would do well here, Charles offered up at many a meeting. He went even further to say that he would help to finance the development of the town, but added, the blacks need to be managed. A consensus was sanctioned, and unfortunately for the clans of the Alpine country, what these white men agreed upon was applied with great haste. Sleeping under the stars and living off the land, Warragunj ran for many days and nights from both blacks and whites. The clan sent warriors, but they didn't search too far as it was too dangerous, and King Jimmy said she wasn't worth the trouble. He blamed her mother's death on Warragunj leaving and shaming her mother by not going with her promised husband. He added that if she ever returned, she would face the consequences. Eventually, Warragunj came across a homestead. She was astounded at the vast size of this gunji and its materials of red brick, which she hadn't seen before. For a moment, she thought she might have run straight off her country and into another world. She approached the building with caution, and a woman a few years older than her own mother came from inside, dressed in cloth that covered her body from neck to foot. It looked as if she were floating. Had Warragunj died in her sleep and entered the land of the spirits? And because of her tainted blood, had she not gone to the promised lands of the dreaming, but to the hell of the white man? Warragunj burst out crying and fell to her knees, beating her head with sorrow. My daughter-in-law Eleanor asked me to come to the window to see. Someone was approaching. My first thought was that it was a white woman in grave trouble. Her clothing was tattered and torn, her long red hair wild as a bushfire. The way the poor thing was taking in her surrounds, I was sure her mind was gone. When she fell to the ground and began to beat her head, I was quite convinced the woman was deranged. I was fearful to go outside, but thought perhaps a gentle, soft, caring female voice could help. I gave Eleanor a pistol and told her to use it if the woman should turn on me. Florence, please, I am not the best shot, Eleanor protested. From out of nowhere came my mother-in-law, Evelyn. She sternly takes the pistol, cocks it with a knowledge I was not aware of, and nods to me. Off you go. Keep the woman on your right so I have a clear shot. As I stepped steadily towards the woman, I realized she was a black. Well, her features gave that impression, but her skin was a grey-white sprinkled with freckles. I had heard of white men lying with the jinns, so this woman was obviously the outcome of the act. Mixed blood. The genes of the white man dominant. By the time she stopped wailing, Evelyn, Eleanor and I were standing before her, and she began to tell us of what happened. She did not speak English, which surprised me considering her skin colour. I assumed she was from one of the surrounding homesteads, some of which took in the blacks for labour. They were skilled with the animals. So through sign language, movement, and drawing in the dirt, Warragunj told her heartbreaking story, her fear of being treated unfairly by her new husband and the other women because of her fair skin and tainted blood. Eleanor was appalled and sought permission then and there from Evelyn to let the black girl stay and be a housemaid. Warragunj hoped she had finally found shelter and acceptance at this homestead with this family, the Edwards family. The elderly woman looked down at her, and as if she had a bad taste in her mouth, she spat. "She'll bring trouble." She turned and left. But Eleanor was determined to make this young woman her responsibility and stood her ground. Unknown to Warragunj, these women were legitimately her family. The oldest woman, the matriarch, Evelyn, was her grandmother. The middle-aged woman, Florence, was Warragunj's stepmother. And Eleanor, who befriended her very quickly, was actually her sister-in-law, the wife of her half-brother Neville. This was Warragunj's white family, her father's family, Charles Edwards' family. Eleanor Markland had married Charles's only surviving son, Neville, the youngest of his and Florence's four children. The eldest son, Charles Jr., had died in a farming accident, and the other son, Philip, had died 2 days after his birth. An older daughter, Mavis, was always sickly and died not long after she was married. The talk was she took her own life. The younger daughter, Bertha, married and moved to Perth on the other side of Australia. She was slow to bring grandchildren into the world, and her interests were in Western Australia, not the Snowy Mountains. Warragunj managed to settle in at the Edwards homestead easily. She liked it there with the three women who appeared to run the property, the boss women. She understood that if she worked hard and was obedient, she would be looked after. Eleanor taught her to speak English. Evelyn did not particularly like Warragunj, but tolerated her for her granddaughter-in-law's sake. Eleanor's enthusiasm for helping someone less fortunate was extreme, and she was chuffed to educate the poor mixed-blood young savage in white ways. She called her Mary. Florence kept to herself and was often away from the property on trips. Warragunj, or Mary, as she became accustomed to being called, was never really sure where Florence went, and often wondered where the rest of their clan was, the children, the white women's husbands. She came to understand that the older woman's husband was dead and would often catch her shedding a tear over the court image of the man. Quickly wiping her eyes when Warragunj entered her room, Evelyn would say through clenched teeth, "You fucking foolish puddin'head djinn. Mary, you knock before you enter a bloody room." Warragunj didn't like going into the room anyway, where the dead man's spirit was caught in the small square fenced area and held in place by the clear material the whites called glass. The image of Evelyn Edwards' late husband sat in a wonderfully handcrafted wooden frame. His eyes followed Warragunj, and it spooked her. The old woman spooked her too. Often, she saw Evelyn staring at her from behind her knitting or needlework, or catch her at the side of the house peering. Warragunj always thought she was doing something wrong with her chores. Then one day, a look of recognition crossed Evelyn's face, which quickly turned to disgust. That night, I found the old woman studying a family photograph that had been only taken the year before, as this photography was very new. The picture featured Evelyn and her husband, Charlie, and Florence, Eleanor and Neville, and another man and woman I did not know. They were not here on the property. I found out this was Bertha, the youngest daughter, together with her husband from Perth. As I moved closer, I became more intrigued by these images caught in time. I did ask Eleanor about them. There were big brick gunjis behind the people. I could see it was a gathering of their small clan. This matched the old man's single image caught in time. The old woman ran her finger over the face of the woman I did not know, and for a split second I looked hard and I saw me, I think. But the old woman was quick to turn sharply, gather the image to her breast, and hissed, "Get out, you heathen bitch! Get out!" I ran, outside and to the barn. It was safer to sleep outside, for there was a look of sheer hatred in the old woman's eyes. She would surely kill me in my sleep. On the occasions when Florence was home, she managed a little conversation with Warragunge, probably hoping the djinn didn't understand her much. She let her secret out that she didn't like the older woman much either, and wasn't really interested in life on the land, preferring city life instead. Warragunge's English was coming along perfectly, and she understood Florence very well. She learnt that the old woman, Evelyn, was Florence's husband's mother, that Florence was bored with life on the land and missed her daughter Bertha. I came to understand it was Bertha in the photo, the one I saw myself in. In passing one day, Florence said I had similarity in looks to her youngest. This I didn't quite understand, but it made her fonder of me, and that was nice. There was a young white boy on the property with them. He was of simple mind, but he and Warragunge got along well. She quickly worked out that he was there to do the manual labour in the men's absence. After his chores, he spent the rest of the day in the barn, carving intricate animal sculptures from bits of wood. He gave Warragunge a little wombat. Beside the kangaroo, this was the next most common animal in the area. There were wombat burrows everywhere, and if you weren't careful, you could easily fall down one and break a leg. Warragunge treasured the gift. She had been with them for nearly 3 months, and her English was coming along fast, so much so that she could hold conversations with the women. One night, the three women were sitting on the veranda enjoying a little supper, when Warragunge came out to serve them their cups of tea. And Florence asked about her finer features and fairer skin. Warragunge told them the story her mother had told her. Florence and Eleanor were appalled, and Evelyn got up and left, mumbling profanities under her breath. Warragunge's fear of the old woman only increased. All through the birthing story, Evelyn had eyeballed Warragunge, and from that day it was clear that the old woman despised her. She began calling her Black Mary. "You might have fairer skin and finer features, djinn, but always remember, you are black, a nigger, a myall, a nothing. Never forget that, Mary. Black Mary." This hurt Mary, who understood the English perfectly. But she did not let her pain show. She just nodded, indicating she understood the old woman, and promised to stay out of her way. After about 8 months, the men came home from a drove and things changed quickly. When Charles Edwards returned home, Black Mary's new world came crashing down. At first, Charles didn't take much notice of the black girl who came to greet him with a quick flash of a welcoming smile and a curtsy. Her head hung low in obedience and in accordance with master and servant. Florence and Eleanor excitedly filled him in on how and when the djinn had shown up there, distressed and hitting her head, how they'd taught her to read and write, and how she was a good hard worker, strong too. Evelyn made her way over, but standing back and looking very stern, and made her son walk to her. Charles leant in to kiss his mother's cheek, and whatever she whispered got his attention pretty quickly. He turned back hesitantly to take another look at the djinn, and saw immediately the resemblance in the black girl who now worked on his property.
By God,
he muttered in disbelief. Black Mary looked similar to his younger daughter, Bertha. He froze in shock as he took her in. Evelyn's concerns were justified. She'd seen the resemblance too, but hadn't mentioned it to Florence. Evelyn had wanted to keep the girl around until Charles came home, to confront him about how stupid and careless he had been to lie with a djinn and have her conceive a child. Still, his wife and daughter-in-law rambled on about what a great help and company Black Mary was. His thoughts raced back to that night with the Narigo clan and the young girl he'd taken at gunpoint and clumsily spilt his seed into. His mother snorted her disgust and stormed off back inside, muttering, "Trouble, blast you all, trouble." He watched her go and then snapped at his wife and daughter-in-law to be silent. The chit-chat could be saved for around the dinner table. For now he was weary and tired and had things to do. Charles knew Mary could be his offspring from the djinn he'd lain with on his expedition to the high country all those years ago. The young djinn before him was the right age and had a frightening resemblance to Bertha. The next day he ordered Black Mary away. Eleanor and Mary cried in each other's arms, which Evelyn and Charles detested. Florence was dumbfounded by her husband's harsh reaction, but he always had the final say. Mary, although she didn't know it, was berated by her own father as he personally marched her down the dirt track and out of the big gates of the property. He pushed her and she fell. Her little carved wombat that she so dearly treasured spilt from her bundle. She scampered to pick it up as her own father kicked out at her. "Get moving, you black bitch, and don't ever come back, or I'll kill you," he hissed at her through clenched teeth. She left with great haste, not once looking back. The rest of the district came to know Warragunj as Black Mary as well. "The whitest gin around!" She became notorious for her feisty nature, sharp wit and beauty. "An untamed filly," the white men would say when they worked alongside her. They lusted after her. Her smarts and bravado kept her alive and stood her in good stead. Over the years, the Edwards family became rich and gave back to the area, as Charles had promised, furthering the progress and development of the old outpost. It was slow going to put the plans in motion, but eventually they started taking shape. The town was to be named after the matriarch of the Edwards clan, Evelyn. By this time, the area was a busy stock route and sales destination. On sale day, people came from all over, so a town was much needed. It was common sense, really, but establishing the town would take time. These days, the business prowess and entrepreneurial skills of Frank Neville Charles Edwards, the only son of Eleanor and Neville, who did eventually give Charles an heir, has taken the family's fortune to even greater heights. They have made money by masterminding a lucrative business in which Frank sells local wool in Melbourne to overseas markets. This endeavour has helped keep other farmers and drovers in work and financed. But it is losing traction now because of the economic depression sweeping the world. Everyone is in trouble, including the Edwards, and that has affected the final stage of development for Everton, the preferred masculine name to Evelyn, which the town's all-male council feels is more appropriate. The locals are desperate to keep Frank in the area so he doesn't take his money elsewhere, which at one stage he and his wife Ulla talked about doing. Frank has also found a wife from the city. When he was a little boy, he often went to Melbourne with his grandmother Florence on her frequent trips. So it is no wonder he is much fonder of city living than life in the high country. He was also educated in Melbourne and received honours in his business degree. But he has kept his promise to his dying grandfather that he will get the town of Everton finished and return to the property and keep it prospering in whichever way he feels is necessary. The property has run into harder times, but is doing all right considering the economic depression. The town plans for Everton have been drawn up and construction is finally underway. Adding to the jailhouse, the old troopers' quarters, the Stanlow Inn, a general store, and a postal house. It is exciting times as the draft horses draped in chains pull the telegraph poles into line down the newly formed street. But one of Frank's priorities is to get the new sale yards built and named before the district's next big sale day. He wants to mark the moment with fanfare, with the first of the thousands head of sheep expected to enter the gates of the Charles Edwards sale yards. It has been two generations since Black Mary stood on the manicured lawns of the Edwards property. Now, at either side of the garden hedge that leads to the front entrance, are two mature rose bushes. The lady of the house, Mrs. Ulla Edwards, née Hosnagle, is a handsome petite woman with mousy hair. Not at all the stereotypical robust German heritage qualities her name might suggest. She prunes the rose bushes, dressed immaculately, as are her children. The Edwards' high standards remain in place, even though the original settlers are all long gone to their resting places. Ulla's 10-year-old daughter, Llewellyn Florence, has sun-kissed golden curls and bright blue eyes, the Aryan race in her genes. She sits at her mother's feet and collects the dying roses, pulling off the petals and placing them in a little basket.
"They smell divine, Mama," she says,
smiling and holding a handful of plucked petals to her nose. Her porcelain doll lies on the ground beside her. The property looks more like a hobby farm than the prosperous sheep station it once was. Empty sheds and dormant machines that once productively worked the farm lie neglected at the back of the house. From behind the barn, 8-year-old blonde, blue-eyed twin boys, Alexander Charles and Frankston Neville, come racing on wooden toy pony sticks. Alexander Charles calls,
"Mother, I just shot me a native."
Ulla, smiling but focused on her pruning, says,
"You say, I just shot a native. But love all, Alexander. We are all God's creatures."
"When will Papa be home, Mama?" Llewellyn asks.
"In a few days, darling," Ulla replies, a smile growing on her lips. "I miss Papa when he goes to Melbourne on business."
"I do too. And next trip, we shall all go.
Promise?"
The little girl smiles, beaming up at her mother.
"I promise."
Just then, an old Chinese woman comes from the house, bringing homemade lemonade. She serves it to Ulla and the children and shuffles back into the house. At the same time, an elderly Chinese man returns, lawn clippers in his hand. They are the servants on the property, prospectors who stayed in the area after the 1850s gold rush came to an end, among the many who did not make their fortune from gold. The land is vast here. The isolated Edwards property sits on the side of a hill, with a breathtaking view out and down to the valley below. The bush is thick and the mountains in the distance roll on forever. From the trees 40 yards away that line the dirt track that leads to the property, someone watches. Chapter 7. The sun's rays reach across the late afternoon sky as if they are trying to hold on to the day. The straw of Molly's homemade broom swishes back and forth, slow but precise. Molly is unwell and lost in thought as she does the mundane chore she has done every day at this time since she arrived to live at the shanty. Her da had her always sweep the front yard, starting at the snow gum and working back towards the front door, sweeping the dirt ground clean of the day's foot traffic. Molly asked her father why, and he answered,
"It's so I know he is about, be it animal or man."
And every morning her da would be first up, reading the land. He was a good tracker and passed the skill on to Molly. She used it well to find and hunt food for them.
This gave comfort to her Da that if anything happened to him, she could look after herself, for a time at least. Molly's tracking skills also came in handy when she had to find her Da after he went on the drink.
Food is all gone, she sighed, thinking to herself.
Danny sits at the fire pit out front, staring at the small flames eating at the last of the burning coal. His siblings are playing around the back. Molly joins her son by the fire, pulling her possum skin shawl around her. She coughs. It racks her body. Danny's rescue the day before has taken its toll. Resting her broom on the log, she takes a seat. Danny turns and smiles as his ma nestles in beside him. He thinks how grateful he is that her rescue attempt was successful. She offers him a little smile, looking down at the ground as a quick flash of yesterday's events rip through her mind. The terrifying thoughts pass, and she looks at him again. She too grateful that she and her boy, no, she and her little man have survived, and will no doubt, one day, tell the tale with smiles and bravado, the horror of the ordeal well behind. Danny sizes up his mother's stomach, puts his little hand under her breasts. Molly sits as upright as she can, and he can tell that the baby has dropped. There is space there. Molly can't help but smile. Her son is far beyond his years. She lets out a little sigh and says, "They gotta know sometime where babies come from." Danny and Molly both smile at the prospect, knowing there will be no trip into the McGuinnesses for the other children for this birth. "I made some Johnny cakes, Ma. Last of the flour, though." Molly releases another sigh, deeper this time, and whispers a curse word under her breath. "And the fish just aren't biting." She looks towards the wood heap, just an armful of broken branches left. She rubs at her temples. Danny sees her anxiety and says, "I need to get onto felling that tree." Molly knows it all too well, and a look of great concern crosses her face. They are in dire conditions, and winter is fast approaching. Danny feels for her and their situation. "It might take me a day or two, or even a week, but I'll get it done, Ma, I promise." Molly smiles again, thankful for this wonderful son, this young man with an old soul. They sit in silence a moment longer. Maturely, Danny offers, "Alligator's not been gone this long before. He's getting old. Maybe..." Deep down he knows that his old faithful may have wandered off to die. Molly takes up the broom to continue sweeping. With the heel of her worn and tattered shoes, she breaks down the tracks of children's feet that have hardened in the once muddy ground, then lightly sweeps it to make a top layer of surface dirt.
"I was going to do that, Ma."
"It's all right, son. I need to move. Body's stiffening up. I'm feeling a little better. Thank you, though." Danny checks the fire. Only the diminishing coals remain. He heads inside and Molly follows, sweeping away his tracks. She works herself back to her front door, and then looks out into the late afternoon, the shadows growing long. The old snow gum stands as the sentinel to her property, its womanly trunk prominent in the afternoon light, its outstretched branches reaching. Reaching for what? Molly would often wonder. Molly stares hard. Is someone there? A cold shiver runs over her as her eyes flick to the wood heap and the dirt mound beneath it. Her eyes dart back out to her surrounds. Hitching up her skirt, she reveals a knife sheath in her sock garter and pulls from this a short blade knife.
If anyone is out there, they'll know this woman means business.
Shaking off the thought, she quickly turns, heading inside, closing and latching the door behind her. Inside, Danny is on the floor writing, practicing his letters. The others are still out the back, squabbling now. Molly is about to call them in when she is distracted by a noise coming from the front yard. It sounds like grunting and snorting. She moves slowly towards the door. Danny is lost in his writing.
There it is again, grunting, snorting and stomping. Molly reaches for the latch, lifting it carefully and placing it quietly on its hook. She cracks the door open very slowly and only a hair's breadth. Her eyes widen with fright. There, standing a few feet from her front veranda, is a bloody big wild grey bullock, its horns the width of a grown man's arm span. She knows the beast could charge at the house at any time and the whole bloody thing would come crashing down without much effort at all. "Danny," she whispers, but Danny is too focused on his writing to hear his mother's concern. Daniel Johnson. On hearing his full name, he brings his attention to his ma at the door. "Gun. Now. Slow." He does as he is told and retrieves the gun, a Cowles & Dunn underlever single shotgun, from the utility cupboard, and hands it to his mother, slow. The other children's squabbling is on the move now, coming around to the front. Still stomping and snorting, the bullock watches them rounding the corner of the shanty. On seeing the beast, they stop dead in their tracks. The bullock lowers its head as if to charge. Molly's breath catches as the bullock jumps forward at the children. She is shaking. She cocks the shotgun, but her action is clumsy and she fumbles. Danny's never seen his mother like this before. Molly raises the gun using the doorframe as her guide, shaking and sweating profusely. Tears well in her eyes. Danny is gravely concerned, not only for her but for his siblings, who are in danger of being trampled to death by this blasted beast of a bullock. Encouragingly, he whispers, "Shoot him!" Molly suddenly finds herself and pushes open the door, causing the bullock to turn and face her. Time slows around her as she steps up to the veranda post and rests her shotgun against it. The beast, lowering its head, digs at the ground with a hoof. Its animal instinct is